that might have been kind of the opening event in possibly the eruptive sequence.
Scientists say an Aleutian volcano has a little indigestion. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, December 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, at least one Alaska Native corporation isn't happy with President Obama's recent offshore drilling bans.
We were providing services to the industry in Barrow, in Wainwright, out of Point Hope.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
It's a fact. Over half of Alaska Native adults don't use tobacco. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message is sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
The state Supreme Court will decide if Alaskans' permanent fund dividends this year were the right amount. That's after Senator Bill Willikowski and two former lawmakers filed an appeal yesterday asking the court to overrule a Superior Court judge. Willikowski, Rick Helford, and Clem Tillian argued that the Permanent Fund Corporation should have transferred the full amount for PFDs, which would have yielded checks worth more than $2,000. But the corporation only transferred half after Governor Bill Walker vetoed the other half. The dividends in October were $1,022. Anchorage Superior Court Judge William Morse ruled in November that Walker had the authority to veto the money. A volcano in the eastern Aleutians erupted suddenly yesterday afternoon, prompting the Alaska Volcano Observatory, or AVO, to issue its highest alert level for aviation. The alert has since been downgraded. Boglasoff Volcano is on an uninhabited island 60 miles northwest of Unalaska. AVO scientist Michelle Combs says several pilots reported seeing an ash cloud about 34,000 feet, nearly the height of a commercial jet above Boglasoff. She says satellite data show a short-lived explosion occurred around 4 p.m., but the activity has since died down. Combs says the volcano seems to have erupted because it was gassy.
It looked like it had a lot of gas in it, a lot of sulfur gas and probably water gas. And so that might have been kind of the opening event in possibly the eruptive sequence.
An eruptive sequence that might include new land forming.
People have seen that the shape of the island has changed, that new little side islands have grown up, and then they're sometimes destroyed either by explosions or just by wave action and erosion.
The area is very dynamic. Combs says over the years, the shape, height, and number of islands have changed. Since the 1700s, Boguslav has erupted 8 times, and Combs says it's hard to know how long this eruption will last. She says eruptions are like personalities.
Some volcanoes tend to, you know, have a big explosive eruption and then go back to sleep. A lot of volcanoes have kind of more longer-lasting, low-level activity.
She says long eruptions lasting weeks or months are common in Alaska. Because there's no ground-based monitoring equipment on Boguslav Volcano, the AVO cannot predict future eruptive activity. Instead, they are monitoring from afar, using satellite images and other data for indications of significant seismic activity. If this eruption continues, it could impact aviators, mariners, and drop ash on nearby communities. Prior to this, the last recorded eruption of Boguslav was in 1992 and lasted nearly a month. President Obama cited subsistence and the needs of Alaska Natives yesterday as part of the reason he decided to block future oil and gas lease sales in Arctic waters. Some Native people welcome the resource protection, but the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation says the president didn't consult with its members and is ignoring the real needs of the Inupiat people. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
To see how offshore development would help the people of the region, ASRC Vice President Tara Sweeney says, look at what happened when Shell was exploring in the Chukchi Sea.
Our communities were working. Our shareholders were marine mammal observers. We were providing services to the industry in Barrow, in Wainwright, out of Point Hope and in our communities. And absent any of those types of opportunities, people are looking for work.
As requested by national environmental groups, Obama put the entire Chukchi Sea and nearly all of the Beaufort in what's known as 12A withdrawals, making the areas unavailable for any future lease sale. Advocates of the move say the withdrawal can't be undone by the next president. Industry associations dispute that, and Alaska's all-Republican congressional delegation says it's already laying the groundwork to cancel the withdrawals. Sweeney says the president is thwarting the needs of Arctic people to have things like toilets, running water, and a healthy economy. It's especially galling to her that the White House, she says, made the withdrawals without discussing it with ASRC or other Native groups.
It's easy for someone in New York or Washington, D.C., an ENGO or limousine liberal to sit there and say, leave the oil in the ground, when they have access to modern amenities that are considered luxuries in the U.S. Arctic.
A White House official said Native corporations and other stakeholders were consulted over several years, not directly for this decision, but when the Interior Department was considering the Arctic for its 5-year offshore leasing plan. A recent poll, sponsored by a pro-drilling lobby, found a large majority of Alaskans support Arctic offshore development. Among Native respondents, the pollsters found 72% in favor. But that's not everyone. Ole Lake works for the Alaska Wilderness League in Anchorage.
I'm very, very grateful for everybody's concern for all the Arctic and Beaufort and Chukchi.
Lake is originally from Hooper Bay. It's well south of the North Slope, but he says Yupik and Chupik cultures like his depend on harvesting the creatures that pass by on their way to the Arctic, and he wants to protect that way of life.
The coastal people have been witness to that magnificent migratory route for thousands and thousands of years and have grown with it.
Lake believes lots of Native people are probably happy the president decided to keep oil rigs out of Arctic waters, but he says they're too busy with subsistence activities to make their views known. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A funeral service for former Fairbanks state legislator and Golden Valley Electric Association chief Mike Kelly was held today. Kelly died December 7th in a small plane crash south of Fairbanks. A preliminary National Transportation Safety Board report issued on Monday says Kelly was testing his plane after the single-engine aircraft had undergone maintenance. The report says the technician who performed the work told investigators he installed generators, skis, a new throttle cable, and alternator on the Balanca Satabria prior to the test flight. The technician also told investigators the aircraft's transponder had been removed for repair prior to the flight. The NTSB report says additional testing of components of the recovered aircraft is pending. Fairbanks International Airport officials say all screening lanes at its airport are now fully functioning. Throughout most of the day today, travelers were faced with hours-long delays after the TSA screening equipment at the airport unexpectedly failed, forcing authorities to screen passengers themselves. The cause of the equipment failure has not been revealed by the TSA. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the fight over how to harvest the tongass continues.
I thought that the cost would exceed the value of the timber and that you would lose money if you bought that timber sale.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, a attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
The U.S. Forest Service wears a lot of hats. The agency oversees federal lands, repairs salmon streams, and auctions off trees. In Alaska, timber sales are intended to stimulate the local economy, but industry groups say through the years, the Forest Service hasn't made enough logs available to keep the industry alive. Now, with changes to federal regulations, even less old growth is slated for market. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins walks us through how a timber sale comes together in the first place.
It might surprise you, but kids know a thing or two about timber. Or at least they used to. Back before the glow of tablets captured the imagination of children, there was this.
So I brought Lincoln Logs.
That'll be interesting.
I'm sitting at a table in Juneau's federal building with Dave Harris, the Director of Forest Management for the U.S. Forest Service Alaska Region. For those too young to remember, Lincoln Logs are the iconic toy that resemble logs. You can stack them to build miniature houses or forts.
Did you ever play with these when you were a kid?
Oh, gosh, yes. And we won't talk about how long ago that was.
But Harris would agree to use the Lincoln Logs to help demonstrate how a federal timber sale comes together in the Tongass National Forest.
So we've just pulled those out of this particular mix.
Although the Tongass is large, what the Forest Service has set aside for market is relatively small, somewhere between 6 to 8%. First, the agency has to figure out where a sale would be viable. Then Harris says the timber sale goes through a lengthy process that includes environmental assessments, an objection period.
There's a lot of steps. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. It's a heck of a lot of work.
From start to finish, it should take about 4 years to complete a sale. It starts with advertising for 30 days, usually in Ketchikan's newspaper. Then the bidding can begin.
You submitted a bid, and you are the high bidder on this particular contract.
How much should I pay for it?
How much did you bid for it? You bid at least the minimum price of what we appraised.
And that's an important point. I can't bid below that. I can't offer less than what the Forest Service thinks the timber sale is worth. But how the agency makes those calculations is hotly debated. Eric Nichols, a partner at Alcan Forest Products, says the Forest Service looks at past timber sales to set the price today.
And when we have market fluctuations, our thoughts going forward can be much different.
Nichols' company specializes in the purchasing, managing, and marketing of timber in Alaska, among other places. It's estimated that a few hundred timber jobs remain in the region. And Nichols thinks, in part, the industry's decline is due to the Forest Service's bad appraisal. Recently, a controversial timber sale on QU Island received exactly zero bids, even after the Forest Service said the trees could be shipped overseas.
I thought that the cost would exceed the value of the timber and you would lose money if you bought that timber sale.
With the exception of Big Thorn, the last sizable timber sale, Nichols says
the volume has been steadily decreasing to the point where the timber industry is in a death spiral at this point in time here.
In January, the Forest Service will start to transition away from valuable old growth logging in the Tongass. That's another barrier Nichols thinks could be bad for business. And federal timber sales are scarce already.
I don't see how we're going to make this transition unless we see some consistent supply coming from the Forest Service.
I think that that's an accurate statement.
Dave Harris from the Forest Service again.
I mean, we have seen our offers decline, our ability to get sales positive, you know, appraising positive, ability to get past some of the challenges.
Harris says the agency is looking at coordinating with other landowners, like the State of Alaska or Mental Health Trust, to make more timber available, trying to bring more life-size logs to the market. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
More Alaskan unhappiness with some of President Obama's recent changes as the operator of Alaska's only coal mine is speaking out against a new Obama administration water protection rule. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, Healy-based Usabelli Coal Mine sees the stream protection rule as an attack on the industry.
The stream protection rule issued by the Federal Office of Surface Mining, Reclamation, and Enforcement updates three-plus decades-old regulations for mining near water. But Usabelli Coal Mine spokeswoman Lorelei Simon maintains the rule is not about improving operations.
This rule was absolutely crafted and designed to put the coal industry out of business.
Department of the Interior officials would not comment on the new stream protection rule, but a department press release says it lays out, quote, reasonable and straightforward reforms, unquote, covering coal mining near streams, including requirements for water quality monitoring and restoration. The department says the rule is the product of a process that began in 2009 and included, quote, 150,000 written comments and statements, 15 open houses and public meetings, and extensive outreach to stakeholders nationwide, unquote. Usabelli Simon counters that the process ended earlier this year without sufficient opportunity for the coal industry to respond.
We just thought it was absolutely laughable because the federal government gave the public 100 days to digest nearly 3,000 pages, the proposed rule, the EIS, and supporting documents.
Simon adds that, unlike its predecessor, the new rule does not account for unique mining conditions in Alaska, like permafrost and surface waters frozen for much of the year.
A one-size-fits-all approach to coal mining. So they took this rule, which we believe they kind of tried to target Appalachia, and then they just smeared it across the entire country.
State regulators charged with implementing the new rule and environmental groups say they're still assessing it. But Kenta Suda with Earth Justice in Juneau points to the basic importance of the new rule in Alaska.
In this state, coal deposits are in many cases coincide with salmon spawning streams.
Suda does not identify any concerns with Usabelli's long operating coal mine near Healy, but says the proposed Chewitna coal project near Cook Inlet is in an area with numerous salmon streams the new rule may fall short of adequately protecting.
It may be a step in the right direction, but we're concerned that it's not as strong as necessary to make sure that coal mining is not allowed within salmon streams here in Alaska.
The stream protection rule takes effect the day before President Obama cedes office to Donald Trump, an ardent supporter of the coal industry, and Usabelli Simon says the company is optimistic the rule will be overturned. Senator Lisa Murkowski, who chairs the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, says Congress will work to do so. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation is still trying to broker a deal to take over the Alaska LNG project, but it will not happen by its self-imposed end-of-the-year deadline. It's the second deadline the project has missed in its timeline for taking over the massive $45 billion-plus Alaska LNG project. Corporation President Keith Meyer told board members today that the transition agreements have taken months to finish. AGDC has gotten the rights to all of the information developed by the project so far. It has also sent notice to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that it will go through the permitting process alone. But that still leaves the question of what will happen to a big chunk of land on the Kenai Peninsula. The project bought 630 acres to house a natural gas liquefaction plant at the end of the pipeline. The corporation also has not taken over a Department of Energy license that would allow the state to export LNG to non-free trade agreement countries. Meyer told the board the negotiations on those points were still in progress, but agreements would not happen until next year. At the northernmost point of the state, in Utqiagvik, Ilisagvik College's Board of Trustees has passed a resolution approving the expansion of the college's bachelor-level degree programs. The school will offer new programs in business administration, with plans to begin offering bachelor's degrees in elementary education. Tennessee Judkins is the college's external relations coordinator.
Business administration has been one of our most popular degree programs, and right now I think since we started that program, we've graduated between, I think, 45 and 50 students who are, you know, interested in coming back and pursuing their degree through the bachelor's level.
With North Slope Borough Assembly approval, the college can now move forward to submit an application to the Northwest Commission on Colleges and Universities to work toward accreditation of the BA in Business Administration.
Because when we were first started, we were started as a training facility through the North Slope Borough and just have evolved over the years. So we've been around for quite some time.
Illisagvik College is a two-year tribal college offering post-secondary academic, vocational, and technical education aimed at matching workforce needs. About 1,700 students are enrolled there.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by
GCI, keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Alaska marked the solstice early this morning at 1:44 a.m. So what does that mean for the amount of daylight across the state? To answer that question, we checked in with Brian Bretschneider, a climatologist in Anchorage who closely tracks Alaska climate data and trends. He regularly talks with editor Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of the segment Ask a Climatologist. He says the amount of daylight depends a lot on where you are in the state.
If you're basically north of the Arctic Circle, so say north of Kotzebue, of course, there's no daylight, so no official sunrise or sunset. And then once you get south of there, say in Fairbanks, you're about 3.5 hours. When you get to Anchorage, it's somewhere in the 5.5 hour range. And then when you get down to Juneau, about 6 hours and 20 minutes.
So it makes a big difference.
It does. And then it really picks up quite a bit more as you head down south of Alaska into the lower 48.
Yeah, so compare that to a few major cities in the lower 48.
Yeah, so places, say, in the northern part of the lower 48, like Seattle or Chicago, you're looking at 8.5 to 9 hours of daylight. And then as you get farther south, like, say, Los Angeles, 10 hours, Miami, about 10.5 hours.
How does the amount of daylight, especially in a place like Fairbanks or Barrow, how does it affect the climate?
Well, when the sun is within, say, about 5 degrees above the horizon, it provides essentially no solar energy. And so the day-to-day climate, even though the sun is out and maybe if it's shining on your skin, you might feel a little bit of warmth, it provides almost no atmospheric heating. So it's just as likely in Fairbanks, for example, that the high temperature of the day would occur at 2 a.m. and the low temperature at 2 p.m. There's really no correlation like you'd find in the summer when the sun is high in the sky and the afternoon high temperature is going to be just after that peak solar angle. It could be any time of the day or night once you get a little bit north of Anchorage.
Does the amount of daylight balance out around the globe over the course of a year?
Well, that's a really interesting question because we kind of we assume that, yeah, it's long days in the summer, short days in the winter, and they all average out. And it's actually not entirely true because of the elliptical nature of our orbit and the tilt of our axis. We actually get more daylight in the summer here in Alaska than we have darkness in the winter. So, for example, up at, if I get the pronunciation right, Utqiagvik, formerly Barrow, in the summer, they have 82 days where there's no sunset, so 24 hours of daylight. But in the winter, they have 64 days with no sunrise. So that's an 18-day difference. So it's not a fully imbalanced, and that solar equation is actually more heavily weighted toward light than dark here in Alaska.
Brian Bretschneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk to see maps of the amount of winter solstice daylight in Alaska and the lower 48. Go to alaskapublic.org. Without much snow, the last couple of years have been tough for many winter sport enthusiasts across south central Alaska, especially cross-country skiers. And conditions have forced an Anchorage organization to rely on artificial methods to keep the ski community alive in the state's largest city. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Snowmaking machines are a common sight for downhill skiers, but not so much in the cross-country skiing community until recently.
It's basically saved Nordic skiing for the past two seasons.
That's Tamara Cornfield. She's the program director for the Nordic Skiing Association of Anchorage. Artificial snow has been used on a portion of Anchorage's trail system in Kincaid Park for a few years, and Cornfield says that process was intended to extend the season.
Basically to save skiing in March, so we do always will kind of preemptively plan the season that way, but it really does help to get coverage on the rest of the trails.
While snowfall so far this season has been better than the last couple of years and a few more trails are open, Cornfield says it's still pretty thin and most of the skiable trails remain on Kincaid's snowmaking loop. She says having to rely so heavily on artificial snow is troubling, not only for the reputation of a state known for being snowy, but she also worries for the future of the sport that's been an integral part of the winter for many Alaskans.
When you're not able to be on snow, you know, kids don't enjoy it as much. So teams suffer, Junior Nordic suffers, you just start to lose the population of skiing. So there will probably be, less skiers at this, whatever age they were skiing for these few years because of that lack of good coverage around Anchorage.
But despite the rough snow years, Cornfield says attendance remains strong at Anchorage's more competitive races, such as the Besh Cup, where skiers are trying to qualify for bigger races like Junior Nationals or Arctic Winter Games. But she says that has not carried over to NSAA's other events.
The local series, the community races, we have seen a drop in participation. Just, I think people just aren't out skiing as much. And then the tour, we haven't seen our typical participation from that because it hasn't been the full length and people just aren't training and it's not one of their goals this year.
Historically, Cornfield says many of the ski-related events around Anchorage built up a large enough following that they basically sold themselves. But now, NSAA is having to put a lot more thought into finding ways to reinvigorate the Nordic skiing community. That effort includes the creation of new events that cater to a broader range of the local population, like the recent first-time event, the Solstice Tree Tour at Kincaid Park, which Cornfield says was a great success.
A lot of people came out to that, and that was it was encouraging families and people who aren't necessarily skiers, and we saw more recreational users and first-time skiers than we have at any of our other events, so that was really exciting.
Ultimately, Cornfield hopes to rekindle the community's passion for the sport and assure it that Nordic skiing is still an integral part of Anchorage, even if it is on artificial snow. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Elizabeth Jenkins and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Josh Edge, Ellen Lockyer, and Annie Fight in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline. Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.